Hi, I'm Bill Arnold. Thanks for listening to the podcast from the Early Morning Late Show. I just heard myself for an ad for Real Recovery. Do I really sound like that? I got to work on my voice. There we go. As I motion toward the microphone, yet another day behind the mic here on Faith Radio, just doing this until I can get a job as a waiter. Everything is in transition, isn't it? And we're all trying to just improve our life situation. So we have Bill English in studio. He's got a big day tomorrow. It's a big day for conferences tomorrow. We got Q Commons tomorrow night, and then Bill's got a conference tomorrow. We're going to talk about that in just a minute, and that's going to be interesting as well. If you are a Happy Days fan, Mrs. C turns 89 today. If you grew up on that show, like I did with the Fonz, Mrs. C, 89. Happy birthday, Mrs. C. All right, we've got a great hour coming up. Bill English, we're going to talk about small business situations, possibly about what's going on with television. Do people even watch regular TV anymore? What's the trend? Are we shifting towards the internet? We're just going to stream stuff on YouTube and Netflix and Hulu and all these other places where we can go and get content. And is TV just losing its popularity? Whoever thought that day would come where we're going, TV's not popular anymore. So it is 5 minutes after the hour. We'll take a break and then start our discussion with Bill English. Thanks for being with us this morning. Be back in a minute.
Paycheck is getting lighter, but I'll take it a day at a time. First of the month keeps it coming up much too much, but I'll make it.
I got to get a sip of coffee here first.
You do too, huh?
Yeah, you got a big cup.
I got my McDonald's. You got a thermos. I got my McDonald's coffee.
Yeah. Drive-thru or did you go in?
Mm-mm.
Drive-thru?
Drive-thru. Who goes into McDonald's?
Who goes in anywhere nowadays?
I mean, my gosh, they could save half the real estate costs just by getting rid of the dining rooms.
Yeah.
Okay, and that was an opinion by Bill.
No. Target now is saying, we'll bring your stuff right to your car. Which I find intriguing. And it's not like they've got a drive-up window. They have someone who works there, gather your stuff, you order it online, they run it out to your car. That, to me, has some appeal.
And, you know, Pilgrim Cleaners here in the Twin Cities will deliver dry cleaning to your front door.
Well,
so
yes.
This personalization
I don't mind
of
that.
Service, I don't mind it either.
Yeah, as long as I never have to leave my car, that's what I'm happy with.
That's right, you are. You sleep in your car, don't you?
Bill, I don't want listeners to know that. Come on.
Give me some
privacy.
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 That's an English way of saying that.
Yes, it is. All right, you were watching the World Series last night.
I was.
As was I. A world record was set last night. The hottest Game one in history, in Major League Baseball history, 9 degrees hotter than any first game ever in Major League Baseball. It was 103 in L.A.
And I wish I could have been there because I love heat.
Do you?
I am not a cold weather guy. My wife is the opposite. You know, the colder the better. Me, the hotter the better.
Really?
Yeah.
That flip-flops.
It does.
Yeah.
And so where do I live?
Minnesota. Yeah.
Right. Because the guy always gives in on that.
Yeah. But it's going to be a great series.
It is.
They say that whoever wins game one has a 62% chance of winning the series. But I would not rule Houston out for a nanosecond.
No, I wouldn't either.
They're fighters, competitors. I like
them. They are. Yeah,
all right,
they are.
Let's talk a little bit about business because this is what we talk about with you. And you saw an ad last night for YouTube.
Well, right before the first pitch of the World Series, YouTube had a two-minute commercial. Now, think about what that cost them. A two-minute commercial to start advertising their YouTube live streaming TV services for $35 a month. And, of course, I went out right away and took a look at it.
Mm-hmm.
And I was stunned at some of the networks that are included in their service, like AMC, BBC, Fox News, Fox Business, National Geographic, Oxygen, not that I watch Oxygen, USA, Chiller, ESPN, and of course the regular big three, ABC, CBS, mm-hmm. and NBC, right? Mm-hmm. All of those are being offered for $35 a month, live streaming with unlimited DVR cloud storage. You get 6 accounts per household, and you can watch it on any device you want to watch it on.
Okay, how do you watch it on your TV? Let me just play dumb, because okay. I am dumb.
And you know what? Believe it or not, my daughter is and I are the only two at home last night, and I go, I think we got to get a new TV because I don't have a smart TV. You have to have
gotcha.
A
okay.
smart TV.
That's what I was thinking.
And she goes, well, let's run to Best Buy. I'm not really into the game. And I said, well, I'm not all that much into it either. So we went to Best Buy last night, and I asked the young kid who knows more than I do about smart TVs. And he says, oh, don't buy a TV for this. If you want to watch YouTube Live, just go over here and get a Roku stick.
Sure.
What's Roku?
The $35 stick you plug in the USB port in your TV, which you probably don't have.
Well, I have two of them now.
Okay, good.
I bought two of them last night at Best Buy,
okay.
right? So I'm now getting into the 21st century in regards to television and all this
yeah.
kind of stuff. And so we're going to hook it up tonight and try it out. But you get all kinds of streaming services
tons
through that.
Of stuff.
Through Roku, through
yeah.
through the – I never knew.
Okay.
I didn't know.
Okay. Now, Bill, let's talk about how this could impact other companies like the major networks. So they're going to sell their content to YouTube?
I suspect that they will. They will package their content and sell it to YouTube based on YouTube's subscribership base
mm-hmm.
and probably based on what they think they need to get out of it in order to be profitable.
Okay, and what about companies like Xfinity and DirecTV?
Oh, I think they're in trouble.
You do?
I do. Because why would you watch Xfinity or DirecTV at $100 or $75 a month when you can do it through YouTube Live at $35 a month?
So I would imagine for those companies to stay competitive, they're going to have to do what they're going to have to do, which is lower their prices, maybe.
Or they're going to have to get into the streaming business themselves. Look, the streaming business is huge these days. And the streaming business isn't just YouTube. There's probably a half a dozen to a dozen other television streaming services which are disrupting the regular delivery of television feeds to the masses. And those delivery mechanisms that we have today are tied to huge billions and billions of dollars in a revenue stream. And it's the revenue streams that are going to be disrupted. And some are going to lose and some are going to win. I suspect the cable companies lose. And frankly, I suspect professional sports is going to lose some.
Hmm.
I don't think they're going to be able to pay the same salaries in the future that they have paid today and in the past, say, 10 to 15, 20 years because the revenue simply won't be there.
So, Bill, competition that is the most threatening to a business does not necessarily come from direct competitors, does it?
Rarely comes direct competitors or rarely what I call head-on competition is usually not your greatest threat. Your greatest threat is usually what I call sideways competition, and that's usually brought on by what happens in the marketplace with regard to technology. So, for example, who would have thought? Now, go back 30 years. Okay, this is back when I was young, and you were even better looking than you are today.
I was in diapers.
Right? But let's go back 20 or 30 years.
Wait, I'm not that young.
You and I are the same age.
Are we?
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay.
Mid 50s.
Yeah, something like that.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
You don't want to say on the air, do you?
I don't care.
Okay.
I don't care.
Well, anyways, we go back.
I'm not saying, but I don't care.
Kodak.
Kodak, yes.
The manufacturer of film for cameras. Who would have thought that their greatest threat to their company would have been essentially the phone industry?
No kidding.
But it was.
Yeah.
When the phone industry went cellular mm-hmm. and these devices started to put cameras inside of them,
mm-hmm.
that was a direct threat to Kodak's existence. But if you had gone back to the boardroom 30 years ago and told them that, they would have, well, why would we care about that? Why would we get into cell phone towers? Why would we get into
right.
that technology? We're a film company. And,
yeah.
And they just would have never seen it coming.
Who would have thought Google would have become a competitor with TV networks?
Well, yeah. That's,
they were just a search engine 10 years ago.
Right. And who owns YouTube? Google.
Mm-hmm. Oh, true. Okay.
Google owns YouTube. And so now Google is essentially a competitor to the whole television industry. And who would have thought that 10 years ago that an internet search company would be a competitor to television stations and networks around the nation today?
What other industries out there are possibly being threatened by some other sideways company?
Oil companies. Oil companies are being threatened by batteries.
Hmm.
Batteries. Now think about this. Tesla is selling cars, and Tesla runs on batteries, so you don't need to buy gas, right? And in 2018, they're going to come out with a model that only costs $35,000. Mm-hmm. They already have over, I think it's over 300,000 pre-orders for that car, and each of those people have put $1,000 down and given it to Tesla.
I did see those numbers, yeah. And they were only able to manufacture like 60,000 or something like that. It was a small number, and they had 300,000 people plunk down a grand to get their name on the list.
I was almost one of them.
Yeah. They're good-looking cars.
They're nice cars. Have you ever driven one? They're fabulous cars.
I have. I've driven one of the high-end Teslas, and they are F-A-S-T.
And think about, well, they also have shingles that you can put on the roof of your house that are solar panels.
I know. I find that so interesting.
And they can absorb the heat or the sun rays. Put that energy into a battery that will power your house and your car. So the coal companies are going to be threatened here.
Mm-hmm.
The local utilities are going to be threatened. And all the oil and gas companies are going to be threatened by this technology.
The rub is always, Bill, how much does it cost to get one of these special roof tiles installed? I mean, usually it's five times the cost of regular tile roofs. And you go, well, who can afford this?
Well, you can't, and that's why people haven't done it to date. But Tesla's roof is actually less expensive than a more conventional 20-year roof.
Yeah, I did see that story, and it was fascinating because you've got built-in energy in your roof tiles, and it doesn't look like ugly solar panels.
So here's the upshot that I would just like to say. If you're a small business owner and you've got technology changes that are beginning to threaten you, you need to recognize that and you need to hop on board and figure it out. But the other thing is that as a Christian business owner, you can listen to the voice of God in your prayer times and ask God, you know, Lord, what's happening in my industry? Father, help me to understand what's going on. Lord, what should I be doing? Are there any threats that I need to understand that are what I call sideways threats? Ask God about that. And James 1 tells us that God will give us wisdom. If we ask, he will give us that wisdom. But let's not doubt. Let's trust God that he will ask, and he'll help us keep our businesses going precisely so that we can help move the kingdom forward in the marketplace.
Bill English will take a little break and then continue our conversation 17 minutes after the hour. So glad you're with us. Just love having you. Love you. Be back in a minute. We're back. It's 20 minutes after the hour. Bill English is in studio, BibleandBusiness.com. We're just talking about business and small business owners. And, for example, the restaurant industry in the U.S. is huge. 57% of us eat out at least once a week. We go to restaurants. I eat out way more than that. But U.S. Consumers are right now spending more money in restaurants than they are grocery stores.
Well, disruption can come not only from technology, but it can come from other sources as well. And restaurants are starting to experience disruption from government regulation and increased minimum wage.
Yeah.
So I go out. Kathy and I eat out probably a couple, three times a month. It's probably all we do.
Mm-hmm.
And there are certain restaurants here we like. But,
yeah. Let me just throw some numbers. There's about a million restaurants in the U.S.
Yeah.
Annual sales, about $780 billion. So this is not a small little business. It employs roughly 12 million people.
Yep.
And the profit margins on restaurants is between 4 and 6 cents on every dollar.
Yeah, about 4 to 6%. So that's a thin
crazy.
Margin. That's a very thin margin.
And most of that it goes to paying wages. So if the government says we have to increase wages at entry level, either the restaurant's got to bump up the prices and possibly run the risk of driving away their customers.
Right.
Or they have no profit.
Or they have such little profit that it really, you know, why do it? You might as well sell the building and the land and make your money that way. Look, I did some consulting with a business owner who owned a number of restaurants here in the Midwest, and he was telling me that the vast majority of his wait staff in the various types of restaurants will make, and these are full-time people working 3 to 4 nights a week, they'll earn between $75,000 and $100,000 a year between the wages and the tips. Okay, now these are not, you know, McDonald's employees. These mm-hmm. these are employees at a Biagio's mm-hmm. Or a nicer type of restaurant. But a lot of waiters and waitresses can earn a very nice living just waiting tables.
Mm-hmm.
And if you come in and you hurt the business owner by raising what he or she has to pay in their minimum wage hourly wage, you really actually harm those individuals. That's the first thing. Second thing, they don't need a raise in their minimum wage
mm-hmm.
because they're doing just fine, thank you, in mm-hmm. their tips. So this is government action that's well-intended but probably is going to have a negative effect. We saw this. They already did this, I think, in Seattle and Tacoma.
Right.
Where they raised the minimum wage on restaurants.
Yes.
And they lost, I want to say, 30% of their restaurants within the first year.
Mm-hmm. And I think the industry, it plays really a very important role in the U.S. in terms of small businesses, because a lot of franchises, they're like a mom and pop store. I mean, you can say that it's a McDonald's, but it's actually owned by a couple, perhaps, and they're running it like a small business.
It is, and usually in their franchise agreements, they're going to have pricing levels that they have to stick to in order to stay true to the brand and to the brand promise. And so if a locale comes in and raises the rates that they have to pay for wages, you know, then they're really stuck between a rock and a hard place.
Mm-hmm. I heard recently that McDonald's is going to home delivery. I'm going, is that a good idea? I mean, McDonald's? I mean, don't you pretty much have to be eating those crispy fries within about 18 seconds of getting them?
I would think that the food would deteriorate within the first 5 minutes and not be very good.
That's my thought too, William. So I'm not sure that's a good idea, but it's going up to 5,000 locations that are going to deliver McDonald's food. And I have to tell you, the stock prices have gone through the roof right now.
Well, they're using the Jimmy John's model, except they can't use the phrase freaky fast.
Right, so. Right. So you've got your big conference coming up tomorrow?
I do, tomorrow. Big conference, best practices. Conference in Brooklyn Park. The whole reason we're doing this is because small business owners continually make decisions that on the surface look to be the right decisions, but they usually have adverse consequences. We're trying to help them understand, here are some decisions that you can make on the business side that will really propel your business forward.
Safe to say everyone has 4 or 5 blind spots in business?
At least one or two.
So let's just say if you're going to come and just maybe have those uncovered, that would be very useful.
It would. I'm telling you, the content is fabulous. If you're a business owner or a business leader, go out this morning to bestpracticesconference.com and take a look at it. Register. It's only $2.99 for the day, and it's the cheapest $2.99 you'll spend all year. I promise you that.
And when we were talking earlier about just the way technology changes business life and the business world, you were talking at the break, Bill, that it's important to spend more time in prayer and being a business visionary for your company. And of course, you've got so much day-to-day stuff on your plate, you have to get outside of that. And a conference like yours would be very helpful in doing that, wouldn't it?
It would be very helpful because you're spending a day working on your business, not in your business. And I really believe that as technology and other changes ramp up, we need to be more time in prayer. God, what am I doing with this business? What do you have for me today? What should I be on lookout for? Again, God has promised to give us wisdom if we ask it, James 1.
And that website again, Bill?
BestPracticesConference.com.
BestPracticesConference.com.
.com.
Thank you. That's where you go to get more information about that, Bill English. As always, thank you for being here.
You bet. Thanks for having me. You bet.
26 minutes after the hour, we'll take a little break, and then we're going to go to Breakpoint. Be back in a minute. It's half past the hour, but in about 9 minutes, we're going to talk to Stephen Mansfield. He's a New York Times bestselling author and a very popular speaker. He first rose to global attention with his groundbreaking book, The Faith of George W. Bush. an enormous bestseller that Time magazine credited with shaping the 2004 U.S. presidential election. He's got a new book out called The Miracle of the Kurds, A Remarkable Story of Hope, Reborn in Northern Iraq. Stephen Mansfield in just about 9 minutes. Be back. Good morning. 24 minutes until the top of the hour. Pastor Rob Morgan highlights the power that reading the Bible can have, especially when we encounter difficult times in life.
The biggest habit that I've found in my life to help me through those times is going to the Bible and finding those promises or those verses that I need for every particular occasion. And we all go through just terrible things. I mean, life is a battle. But there is never a burden that we'll ever face without a Bible verse that God will give us to go through it. And in some of the darkest valleys, I have found verses of Scripture that have sustained me. You know, the Bible says, even though we walk through the valley of the shadow of death, we will fear no evil. He is with us. His rod and his staff comfort us. And to be able to reach over to your Bible, you know, my conviction is that God has given to us a book that is small enough to hold in our hands, big enough to study all of our lives, and satisfying enough to meet our needs forever. And what I've done with this book, The Strength You Need, my wife and I found 12 Bible verses, and we have just drilled into those verses like an oilman drilling for petroleum in Texas. And I will tell you, God's Word gives us the strength we need when we don't have it on our own.
That was Pastor Rob Morgan. If you want to hear that full interview, head over to myfaithradio.com, type in Joy Choice or Rob Morgan. You will get there. I have on our studio line Stephen Mansfield, a New York Times bestselling author. Cannot wait to speak to him. We'll take a short break and then get him on the program.
The world our kids live in today is far different from the one you and I grew up in. As kids move into their teen years, they face unimaginable pressure to turn away from the values you've worked so hard to instill in their lives. Hi, I'm Mark Gregston with Parenting Today's Teens. Raising kids in church, homeschool, or a Christian school is no guarantee they'll turn out to be the godly, refined adult that you're hoping for. In fact, many parents wake up one morning to discover that their teen has changed into a person they don't even know. Is that your experience? Doing everything right, only to find it didn't work? Teens today need moms and dads who are constantly adjusting their parenting style to fit the times. If things aren't working, don't keep doing what you've always done. Change it up.
Look for the new book from Mark Gregston titled Leaving a Legacy of Hope when you visit parentingtodaysteens.org.
Thanks for listening to the program this morning. It's 20 minutes until the top of the hour. Stephen Mansfield is a New York Times bestselling author, and when you are a New York Times bestselling author, you don't have to wear a necktie very often. Yet I bet he can still tie a great full Windsor knot. Stephen, welcome to the show.
Good morning. Good to be with you.
Thank you so much. Congratulations on all of your work and your most recent book on Donald Trump. Boy, what kind of response are you getting to that so far?
Well, largely positive. I mean, people like the fact that I, you know, I'm trying to tell the truth and trying to be factual. But of course, you know, you're going to have people on both sides. They're going to be upset with any book that's tries to be sort of centrist and tell the facts as they are. So I've had some heated interviews, and I've also had some wonderful ones.
Yeah. And the name of the book is called Choosing Donald Trump, God, Anger, Hope, and Why Christians Conservatives Supported Him. And you look at the opening paragraph, Stephen, and it talks just really about the odds that Donald Trump was up against. He had some pretty daunting challengers. You think of him running for president against a Baptist minister, two sons of pastors, a slate of Republican candidates, most of whom consider themselves evangelicals. And yet he won.
He absolutely did. It's stunning. And I think it's a little bit more understandable to see why evangelicals would have rallied to him in the general election, where Hillary Clinton was the main alternative. But in the primaries, where you have people who are far more evangelical-friendly, many of them evangelicals themselves, pretty surprising that Donald Trump came out the front runner. I know in the early days, the evangelicals did not rally to him. But as it was obvious that he was going to be the front runner and obvious that he was going to be their champion against Hillary Clinton, they rallied to him. And it's one of the big faith stories of recent electoral history.
Mm-hmm. What do you think of the fallout that still continues to this day? It's almost been a year now, and people are still reeling from this election.
Yeah, it was a real shocker. You know, I pay close attention to some of the best statisticians and prognosticators in D.C. where I live. And none of them had this right. I mean, some people claim to have had it right since then, but almost none of them had it right, at least as far as I knew. I think it is a tremendous shock on both sides. But since then, in the, 8, 9, 10 months since then, I'll have to say that it doesn't, even though Donald Trump is, we all know, raw and crass and petty and bombastic, he does not seem to have lost that evangelical core, that religious conservative core who supported him and pretty much put him in office. So it's an interesting time, and as we all, as we're seeing even this week in the news, a lot of tensions up on the Hill.
Stephen, what are some of the things we can point to with Donald Trump that evangelicals can feel a little bit better about?
Well, the things that, that keep them in the game are his Supreme Court appointments. I've even had people say to me, prominent evangelicals say, look, as long as he appoints conservatives to the Supreme Court, I can hang with him on all the pettiness and all the Twitter wars and everything else. As long as he is basically for religious liberty, as long as he champions an abolishment of the Johnson Amendment, as long as he brings jobs home, as long as he's America first, these are the phrases that you hear. So I think he, you know, was a perfect storm in the election. He sounded the tone that a majority of religious conservatives and a majority of people on the right wanted to hear. And the other candidates, the other Republican candidates in the primaries, either ran pitiful campaigns or just didn't sound that certain trumpet that rallied the troops like Trump did. So if he, as long as he continues to stay committed to those pillars of evangelical political concern, I think he's going to be fine with that group.
Mm-hmm. Stephen, what do you say about the media, the way they're treating President Trump right now? And I mean, even President Carter came to his aid yesterday or the day before saying, yeah, they're pretty tough on him.
Well, the media obviously wants to see him removed. They're for the most part opposed to him. In fact, some of the TV shows I've even enjoyed watching, some of the news shows, have become a little boring because it's anti-Trump all the time. They're going to have to find another tone. I mean, it's just it's going to eventually get boring, and it's not really going to work. You're not going to drum up enough attention to the president's latest misstatement in a tweet or latest raw moment to get him impeached, which is what some people started out wanting to do. So the media is without question arrayed against him. We know that. That's just the way the game is played. And I think that they're going to have to moderate, or they're going to start losing the American people even more than they already have.
Mm-hmm. Stephen, why did Christian conservatives get so excited about him during the election season? What were they seeing in Donald Trump that, despite his crassness and his ambiguity on some faith statements that he made, that just had all of us scratching our head a little bit? We continue to say, yes, we want him. We want to support him.
Well, I think it's a great question, and I think we have to understand the context. The average religious conservative, and we have to remember that Donald Trump pulled 81% of white evangelicals, half of all church attenders, half of all Roman Catholics.
Mm-hmm.
That crowd felt traumatized by the Obama administration. The people were speaking literally of a war on religion from that administration. And then they saw, frankly, Hillary Clinton as more of the same. And so it was a moment in which an alternative, even an imperfect alternative, was going to be just hoped for, prayed for, reached for. And then I'll have to say, even though some of the people who ran in the primaries against Donald Trump were my friends, there's just atrocious campaigns. It was Jeb Bush's to lose, and his campaign was really, really faltered a great deal. Others sort of got knocked off balance, misbehaved. Marco Rubio later apologized for how far he got knocked off balance and some of the crass things he ended up saying. So those campaigns just failed, and they did not prove themselves as viable alternatives. And there was Donald Trump. He was sounding the right tones. He was angry about Obama. He was harsh on Hillary Clinton. He was sounding the America First theme. He had newly learned the concerns of prominent religious figures around the country because Paula White had scheduled listening sessions for him. So he was conversant about the Johnson Amendment. He was conversant about religious liberty. He was conversant about the quote-unquote war on Christmas, etc. And he knew how to sound those tones and merge it with his economic nationalism message. And all of that proved just to be too much of a draw for even people who had not voted in recent elections. And so he took the lead, and I think that's what delivered the election to him.
Mm-hmm. I'm speaking to Stephen Mansfield. I'd like to take a break. When we come back, I'll have more conversation with him. His latest book, Choosing Donald Trump, God, Anger, Hope, and what's the last word there?
And why religious conservatives supported him.
That's exactly right. Stephen, thank you so much for your help there. We'll take a short break and be back in just
a
minute.
Bet.
We're back. It's 12 minutes until the top of the hour. Speaking to Stephen Mansfield, New York Times bestselling author. His latest book, Choosing Donald Trump, God, Anger, Hope, and Why Christian Conservatives Supported Him. Stephen, you know, Donald Trump said, you know, he said, I think people are shocked when they find out that I'm a Christian, that I'm a religious person. Of course, he says a lot of stuff like that, but then he'll make statements like, well, I've never asked for forgiveness, which really is at the core of what being a Christian is.
Yeah, you know, it's very interesting with Donald Trump. He is a guy raised in church, very much influenced by Norman Vincent Peale. And this, I think, is the part of the dichotomy that we see in him every day. Norman Vincent Peale said himself that he believed in the quote-unquote born-again gospel and preached that at his church at home. But Norman Vincent Peale publicly, internationally, was a motivational speaker. You know, he wrote the popular Power of Positive Thinking. He was known for phrases like attitudes are more important than facts, etc. He believed you could shape your reality through your words and your attitudes. So we're familiar with that culture today. So basically, there were two streams coming out of his life, and I think that Donald Trump fed more from the motivational stream. So Donald Trump says, I was in church, and he was. And he definitely got, you know, the basics of the Christian gospel, but most of what he got was you can win. You can shape your destiny. Your attitude is key to your destiny. You can frame your reality by your words. A lot of things that we are very familiar with today in motivational culture. So it is true that he's churched. It was true he's raised as a Christian. It's true that he is a Christian in the sense that he identifies with the Christian faith, but his main mentoring was from a man who, though personally born again, talked mainly motivational speak and motivational philosophy. And I hear that in Donald Trump's statements every single day. And I think that explains a lot of who he is religiously.
Mm-hmm. Trump was very eager to be accepted by conservatives, wasn't he?
He absolutely was.
He worked quite hard at it, didn't he?
Yeah, he did. He really did. And the key to this is the woman I have a whole chapter on in the book, Paula White. Paula White is the, you know, blonde, good-looking television preacher who's so well-known. They had become friends over time, and when he decided to run, he asked her to hold some gatherings around the country with prominent clergy, and basically they were listening sessions for him. And she really, I think, deserves the credit for a lot of his victory, for a lot of his appeal to religious voters, for a lot of the way that he pulled, you know, most of the prominent conservative religious figures in this country, because she scripted those listening sessions. She made sure she explained what they were talking about to him. This is where he heard about the Johnson Amendment. This is where he heard about the troubles in the inner cities. This is where he heard about some of the racial tensions he eventually became a little bit sensitive to. This is where he heard about religious liberty issues. And when he sounded those tones in the campaign, people rallied. But he had done a graduate seminar on those topics under the tutelage of Paula White and the people she gathered in those meetings.
Mm-hmm. Stephen, what were some of the chapters in your book, or what chapter in particular did you get the most amount of pushback from, or when you've done other interviews, who's come up against you the hardest?
I think that probably the strongest pushback I have gotten is where I say, and again, I'm speaking to some of my friends, but I say that some of these prominent religious leaders way oversold Donald Trump. I talk about maintaining prophetic distance in the book, and I say, look, we as Christians and Christian leaders can endorse a candidate. We can call him to him or her to her to their best. We can hold up biblical values for them as things we'd like to see in policy. But we do not need, we should be cautious about, quote unquote, to use the crass phrase, getting in bed with them. We should be cautious about joining their PR firm. We should be cautious about doing a rebranding. And that's definitely what happened during the election. And I think that there's going to be some blowback for the way that a lot of our prominent evangelical leaders got so fully behind Donald Trump. We saw people talking about how he was Lincoln, how he's Churchill, how he's Cyrus the Great, how he's Darius, how he's Reagan. In one single introduction at Liberty University, a man I love very much, Jerry Falwell Jr., compared Donald Trump, first of all, called him the greatest visionary of our time and offered to have a Trump Tower at Liberty University, and then proceeded to compare Trump to Martin Luther King Jr., to Reagan, to Jesus, to his own father. I mean, this was an attempt to rebrand Donald Trump for the religious audience, and I think that we may pay for it. I think now evangelicals own Donald Trump, so to speak, to use the slang, and I think we may end up owning it. So to answer your question, this theme in the book, that really is in a couple of chapters towards the end, has been the one most controversial because I take even some of my friends to task.
Yeah, and I would imagine that you have taken a hit with some of your friends, and maybe some of your friends are not as nice to you as they once were, unless you buy lunch.
You know, I don't really agree to buy lunch very much. I figure they owe me. So, no, I'm just playing. Yeah, you know, whenever you're going to write, you know, I remember my Southern grandmother saying, don't talk about religion and politics in polite company. Mm-hmm. And I do that for a living. So I'm used to having even my friends sit down to dinner and go, what the heck are you talking about? And so, you know, when you write about religion and politics, it's going to be bumptious. It's going to be controversial. You're even going to have your own family members turn to you and go, man, I do not agree with you. But that's fine. At least we're having a friendly dialogue and we're doing it over something good to eat. I prefer that to the yelling and screaming and, you know, cable TV scream fest that we're all dealing with that just polarize.
Mm-hmm. We're not accomplishing much with all the rhetoric and all the yelling. And a lot of Christians are very put off by a lot of the things that President Trump has said and the style in which he has used, and certainly has created a lot of controversy.
Well, and that's why I wonder why we can't maintain some prophetic distance. I know of churches that have virtually split. I know of large families that have been meeting for Thanksgiving dinner for generations and now haven't over the election issues. I know of friends who are no longer speaking to each other. I know of companies that have been damaged by political discussions in the lunchroom. And political differences have been the norm in American history. That didn't keep people from being friends. It didn't keep Tip O'Neill and Ronald Reagan from drinking whiskey and playing pinochle at the end of every day after beating each other up on the floor.
Right.
So we've just got to learn how to have a political dialogue. And I want to say very, very quickly that part of the problem here, you know, the founding fathers knew that when politics becomes everything, we've already lost.
True.
The whole idea of limited government was there were more important things about life, like love and family and children and poetry and beauty and art and industry. Those things were more important. And part of the problem that's happening right now is that if everything becomes politics, if every relationship becomes primarily political, well, then we've already become socialists and we've lost the founding vision. So we've got to tame this dialogue and get back to some civility and some containment of our political concerns.
Mm-hmm. Stephen, I just have less than a minute left, but have you been live at an event where Trump has been speaking? Were you like at the prayer breakfast, the national prayer breakfast?
I have. Yes, I have.
What was he like coming across to that group?
You know, Donald Trump can be extremely engaging. He's very personable. He's got that same gift that George W. Bush did for coming in a room and slapping backs and grabbing people around the neck and pulling them in close. And he's kind of got that old boy thing. It's not until he starts making the speech and he you know, fires a shotgun at some people that you start to get into trouble. But he can be extremely engaging, and obviously that's part of what's gotten him to where he is.
Yeah. Stephen, thank you so much. Stephen's book, Choosing Donald Trump, God, Anger, Hope, and Why Conservative Christians Supported Him, is a brand new book. You can go to Amazon.com and get a copy yourself today. Thanks for being a guest, Stephen. Great to have you.
Great to be with you, buddy.
Yep.
Bye-bye.
3 minutes until the top of the hour. We'll take a short break and be back to wrap up the show.
Something without one another.
Thanks for listening to the show today, and thanks to all my guests, Stephen Mansfield, New York Times best-selling author. If you want to go check out, I think you get a free chapter sample, so maybe go to Amazon.com and download the first chapter and read it and see if you want to give it a ride. Otherwise, thanks to all my guests, Bill English, who is also in studio, Kent Kaiser, and Gabe Lyons. It's been a great show, and thank you for listening. I'll see you tomorrow. Thanks for listening to the Early Morning Late Show podcast. These conversations are available because of your prayerful and financial support. Make a gift now at myfaithradio.com. To avoid missing future editions of the Early Morning Late Show, subscribe to the podcast today at iTunes or your podcast player. And thanks for sharing this audio link with a friend and grow the impact of the Early Morning Late Show.